Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Enterprise Sales Development Podcast, brought to you by Cyence Technologies. We interview outbound leaders at fast growth businesses to learn their secrets and bring you actionable insights. Thanks for joining us this week.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Enterprise Sales Development. I'm Eric Quantz from CMO at Cyence. Today's episode, drum roll, please. We have got the multi-talented, the frankly amazing Ashley Early. And day job, Ashley Early, head of sales at the Duckbill Group. She also hosts the Other Side of Sales podcast. She also runs a sales consultancy, really an SDR consultancy, called The Other Sales Coach and Consultant. She's been in the space for quite a while, has seen a thing or two, has done a thing or two, former head of sales development at Okta. Boy, her experiences lend a very insightful perspective. And that's really what you're going to get out of this episode. She talks a lot about process building, talks a lot about how to be an effective SDR manager, talks a lot about, you know, what's actually not captured in quota, and maybe even how to set quotas more properly. There's some controversial topics. There's some opinions that fly, really well-formed ones, I might add. You're going to have to listen to this episode. I think you're going to take a ton of value out of it. Without further ado, let's get to it. Here's Ashley. Here talking with you, Ashley. I think that one of the things that I get a good sense that you're most passionate about is sales development.
It's an interesting thing because it's a very, I'd say yes, but I'm going to refine that a little bit because it's not sales development. It's I'm excited about two things specifically really get me going. One is helping people launch their sales career, because I really believe sales is one of the few careers that you can have pretty much regardless of wherever you came from and whatever you're dealing with. I can think of very few, if any, backgrounds or health conditions or anything like that that would prevent you from having an incredible meteoric career in sales. So that gets me really excited. And the other thing gets me excited about it is I love process building and tweaking processes and getting super experimental and science-based with it. And sales development is the easiest place to do that. There's always things to tweak and fix and refine and stuff like that, and putter, if you will.
Well, and one of the things that you've done is actually kind of sales development consulting and putting in that process for a number of organizations. Give me a little thumbnail sketch on the ability to walk in as a consultant and change things around to great effect.
Yeah, I think there's a lot that comes from having built a system myself. I've built a ton of systems myself, and now going in from the outside and coming in and trying to help people. They don't bring me in if everything's going great. Very few people are going to pay my rates to get me to come in and say, great job. That's not going to happen. Honestly, I wouldn't take that work to begin with. You've got better, at that point, you know where you can spend your money better anyway. So you've built a system. Usually it was working and it stopped and you're not exactly sure why, or you're seeing a gradual decline and you can't stop it. A lot of times at that point, it comes down to something as simple as just lost perspective. You're too close to it. You know, it's, oh, we can't do that because, you know, the AEs want it this way. Oh, we can't do that because sales ops says that's not possible. I can come in and be like, are you sure? Like, do they really, you really want, okay, so let me, like, my favorite one is, oh, well, the AEs or sales is insisting that all sales leads need to have budget confirmed. Really? You really don't want to take a meeting because they don't have budget allocated yet? Okay. So do you want 30 leads a month or do you want 3? Your call. We can do either. But you want to increase your lead flow. Let's just start by like removing that hurdle. Then it turns into, okay, fine, we'll do budget, but it has to be the ultimate decision maker. We'll only talk to director levels and higher. Really? Are you sure? And sometimes it comes down to, especially I think so often, I'd say 95% of organizations, the most junior manager in the entire sales and marketing department, i.e. the person who has the least amount of management experience, both people management and just building teams and stuff, is the sales development manager. So you're putting the least experienced person in charge of possibly the most complex team that reports to, they're responsible to marketing, they're responsible to sales, they're responsible to operations, responsible to several different masters. And how do you manage all those different masters successfully? That's freaking hard if you're an experienced manager, let alone someone who was an SDR yesterday. So you've also got very junior people who don't either A, know how to, or B, are not enabled to speak up. So a lot of times what I end up coming in and doing, I can think of two examples in the past 6 months I've come in, work with the SDR manager, the leadership brings me like, yeah, we're not really sure if they're doing a good job or, you know, if they're the right person in the role anymore. We want to set them up for success. We don't want to go out and rehire. We like them. We see potential in them, but they're not performing. They being the SDR manager. And I'll come in and be like, yeah, so do these 10 things. And more often than not, the SDR manager is like, remember when I suggested every single one of these things 6 months ago and you guys overruled me?
Right.
It's a lot of time, I'd say at least 60 to 70% of the time, what I'm recommending is stuff that the manager's already recommended.
Yeah.
And then it's turning it into a trust building exercise of, hey, if they did recommend this, maybe next time don't spend X tens of thousands of dollars to bring me in. Listen to them. Right. I'm fine with that. You know, yeah. Or turn this into a coaching thing where I'm working with them once a month or twice a month. And then you don't have to do this full intensive process anymore. But it's this weird thing we've got around, oh, well, sales development are junior people, so they can have junior managers. No. Experienced people can handle junior managers. Junior people cannot handle junior managers. It's hard.
And oftentimes you're even a double whammy of most SDR managers came from a previous SDR role. And why did they get promoted? Because they were really good SDRs. So you're taking off the floor some of your most productive like SDRs to begin with.
Yeah. And it's a couple different things. And we see this in AE roles too. Like, oh, hey, so-and-so was, you know, President's Club 5 years in a row. Let's have them be a manager. They'll teach everyone else to be. No. Managers, it's when people ask me what I'm looking for when I'm hiring leaders and stuff like that, it's the three biggest things I look for in a first-time manager are they instinctive teachers? You can learn to teach. It is absolutely a skill you can learn. It's a lot easier if you've got it to begin with. And especially since I'm typically dealing with high growth startups, there are enough people out there that have a teaching instinct or have a teaching background, even literal teachers. That's one. So an instinct for teaching that can show up as being a leader on the team, building collateral, stuff like that. Second is a nose for systems. They have to be someone who's comfortable with systems, period. They need to be able to call BS on operations. Not that operations is trying to screw over sales dev, it's just such an intensive role that you need to have the ability to double check and to challenge when appropriate. Again, you can learn it. It's a lot easier if you've already got it. And then the third thing I look for is a really high sense of emotional intelligence. And again, that just comes with, a lot of people call it maturity. I like calling it emotional intelligence because I've met people who were very quote unquote immature that had a very high EQ. And I've met people who were a lot older that had a very low EQ. So I like saying that instead of maturity, but they're kind of the same thing. But if you've got those three things, you should be fine if you're properly enabled. None of those have anything to do with sales performance. Now, that said, if you've got those three and no sales performance, you've got a really high learning curve. So that's assuming there's some sort of baseline of this person has a history of meeting quota, not necessarily top of the whatever. I was, I think, top of the leaderboard in my entire career in sales, maybe 2 months ever. My teams were consistently the top performing teams in the company.
Is that one of the reasons why those three are so like indexed highly for you?
A bit. I definitely had, yes, I had all three. So yes, yeah. there are things I learned from my own experience. But there, when I look at my peers who struggled and my peers who did well,
I
stumbled on that because I had them, but it kind of vets out anecdotally in what I see across the board. And you'll find a lot of managers, if they're really honest, we'll say the same thing because the fact of the matter is 95% of sales reps are not top of the leaderboard.
By definition.
Exactly. By definition, they're not. So why are we all like, oh, if you're not top of the leaderboard, we don't want to hire you.
Yeah.
No? And there's a lot that goes into performance that's not captured in quota. Like one of the things I really push for people to talk about in interviews is you can't just ask for quota. You have to ask for context.
Mm-hmm.
So asking for like, tell me about your best quarter, tell me about your worst quarter, what happened? So somebody asked me about that years ago and it's turned into one of my favorite interview answers because my best quarter was also my worst quarter. And very specifically, my best quarter, my worst quarter as an SDR, I think I got 46% of quota. It was terrible. It was horrific. It was a slaughterhouse because I had specifically New York and Long Island in the fall of 2013. I had New York and Long Island during Hurricane Superstorm Sandy. My territory shut down for 3 months. The fact that I got 46%, I think, is a miracle and a testament to my work ethic, my empathy, my ability to make things happen when they really shouldn't, and kind of go from there. So it turned into like, that was my worst performance quarter, but it also, I defy anyone to get better than that.
The true definition of bigger fish to fry on your prospects side of the fence.
Yeah, I spent 2 months literally going, like every cold call was, hey, this is Ashley Early with FireEye. Well, first of all, before I dive in, are you okay? And is your family okay? Every call started like that for literally 2 months. And the number of people who would just let, it was really rough actually, because I had a lot of people, you know, and this is security. I had a lot of like VPs of security talking about living in FEMA trailers with their kids and having to redo their houses and their parents having to move in with them because their parents' house has literally been sucked out to sea. And they're, you know, it was story after it was thousands of stories just by me asking, are you guys okay? 90% of those were not meetings. But a remarkable amount turned into meetings 6 to 9 months down the road. The quarter after that quarter, so Q4 was the worst, Q1 was a little bit better, Q2, I think I hit close to 150. That was the only quarter, I think, at that company I was at number one on the leaderboard. And the majority of those meetings were meetings that came from people that I had started talking to in the fall, because they all came back on and they remembered that nice girl who took the time to listen. So let me go take the time and listen to her now. Oh, and her company's actually really freaking cool. So it's a long game. It's all these things. And I really do believe in karma as well. Like, if you need to chew me out right now, chew me out right now. It's fine. I can be the villain in your story. That doesn't hurt me.
Sure.
But at the same time, just being open like that did a lot. And so that it's that context, that the better and the worse, what happened around your quota, that speaks to the skills of the sales rep, not necessarily their quota performance. And that's something we as an industry are going to have to wrestle with over time, because every company decides quota differently, SDR and AE.
So, you know, true.
Like we've heard, you know, we've all heard the horror stories. I mean, a lot of us didn't want to get into sales because we all heard the horror stories about sales teams where the bottom half performers are laid off every quarter.
Yeah.
And obviously that doesn't happen anymore, but clearly if you're laying off the bottom half of your performers, you've designed the quota system in such a way that half the team will always underperform, you know? So we've moved generally away from that in most industries. We're looking closer to, you want 85 to 95% of your team to hit every month. I personally believe quota should be designed so that everyone should hit every month, just from a psychological mental health perspective. You're better off kind of having a slightly lower OTE, but then having everyone overachieve consistently every month. It costs the company the exact same amount of money, but having them overachieve a little bit, everyone feels productive as long as you set the goals kind of across the board like that. So you don't have like one team overperforming and the other team's under. It's harder math, but it makes a big, big, big difference in retention, in stress levels, in all that stuff. It's the same reason I think you have to make sure that you're paying a living wage for the markets that you're in. Sorry, SDRs cannot get by on $70,000 in San Francisco. Half that money is going to go to rent. Then you've got people, I don't want my SDRs worrying about how they're going to make rent or how they're going to pay their bills or stuff while they're at work. I want them comfortable and relaxed and focused on their job, not stressing about, can I afford to refill my gas card or my BART card?
Right.
So.
Well, and I think that also alludes to the fact that a lot of quota design is not that rigorous. A lot of it is based on historical norms and or a number that somebody pulled out of the thin, you know, the clear blue sky, rather than the rigor part would be deconstructing one's own average contract values, working out the margin, you know, kind of like splits, and determining what an appropriate customer acquisition cost would be in light of, you know, close rates for that exact product or service.
And then what a lot of companies miss is taking that math. You have to kind of have to do this math three times to gut check it. You start with, I need to make this much money. That means I need to generate this much pipeline, which means I need this much activity of these types. Great. That's plan one. Makes sense. Now we got to put reality onto that, because everyone's going to say, I want to make $5 million this year. That's great. Doesn't mean that can work. Then you got to throw on the lens of realistic conversion rates. So if you have historical, great, look at historical. I work with a lot of companies that don't have historical, or the historical they have is horrific. It's just not good data. Then you have to go with kind of, I hate using them, but kind of bog standard industry conversion rates. And then I add typically, like I'll typically drop them, make them even worse.
Yeah.
Because if no one's heard of your company, it's going to be worse.
Right.
I don't care how incredible your product is. No one's going to listen to the pitch if they haven't heard, if they can't get past the name of the company. If they've heard of the company, they're more likely to hear the pitch. If they haven't heard of the company, you're going to get far less at-bats. It's just human nature. I'm sorry. So we look at that. So like if a bog standard conversion rate is kind of the 100 calls, 5 conversations, 1 meeting. We've all heard that math. If you are an unknown startup, double it, if not triple. It's just the way it is. And prove yourself wrong. Oh no, it's higher than that. Shoot. Plan for the worst. Then do that math and realize, okay, is that amount of activity mapping to the math that we just did earlier on? I want to make 5 million down to the number of activities. Usually it doesn't match. Usually industry conversion rates will end up with, oh, I need to make 700 emails a day, where the original math said I only need to make 50. Try again. So try and find a middle ground and go from there. Then the last layer you have to put on is kind of the layer of time. And that's the layer that I think a lot of people miss, which is the time to take notes, time to update the CRM, time to do trainings, time to do just general housekeeping and relationship building with your AEs and with other people, time to do dark social. I am an absolute convert on social and dark social for the right industries. Obviously, if you're targeting, you know, project managers in construction, probably not, but you never know. Twitter could be a great place for you. Doing dark social and stuff like that, that will not have an easily trackable correlation, but will absolutely have a big impact. So you have to factor in kind of the time factor for those things. So like a lot of, I talk to a lot of, especially like engineering leaders, and they're like, oh, well, my team's only doing 30 calls a day. I don't understand why they're not doing more. Okay, walk me through their day. Oh, they're spending 5 to 10 minutes researching every prospect before they call because you told them they have to hyper-personalize every pitch. Okay, that makes sense. So 10 times 30, that's 300. That's, you know, we can round that and say that's 2.5 hours. No, I did that wrong. I'm terrible at mental math, whatever that mental math is. Then you have to factor in an hour or two for email. Then you have to factor in, they're going to have to do some Slack time and stuff like that. All of a sudden, the CEO's eyes are just like, you know, turn into saucers because they realize, oh, that's where their time's going. Yeah. They can't just pick up the phone and dial. No, because you haven't set them up to do that.
300 minutes is actually 5 hours. So the bigger... takeaway is like there aren't enough hours in the day depending on how you set the structures. But I wanted to go back to something that you said because I see a thread of continuity in it, which is, you know, you talked about, and I'm imagining these are a number of your clients that have hired you and brought you in, you know, effectively, like, why concentrate on dark social? Well, because that's where awareness can be generated. And brand names, like, ultimately become brand names because of familiarity and because of repetition and because of like being out in the feeds of or exposure to impressions is the ad word that we would use.
Yeah.
All of that matters, doesn't it?
All of it. It's like there was a really good stat. I don't know if it still holds true because I heard this for the first time about probably 8 years ago now, and I don't remember where I heard it. But they said Harvard Business or something like that. But it said a person is unlikely to visit a website until they've heard the name somewhere else 8 to 10 times.
Yep.
So that's how I kind of train my, when I'm working with AEs and SDRs, I give them that kind of numbers. Like, look, they're going to need to see your name 8 to 10 times. You can't rely on marketing for that.
Right.
So that might need to be email subject lines. It might need to be social. It might need to be referrals. It's all sorts of stuff like that that can really, it's one-to-one interactions, not one-to-many. That's why it's not marketing. Social can be one-to-one. You can make a post that is designed for, you know, tagging 10 people you've spoken with in the past week or two. That's absolutely feasible. And they see it again. They talk to you on, you know, you'd have a little quick exchange on LinkedIn. Do not pitch slap. When I'm talking about talking to people on LinkedIn and social, you are not pitching them until asked. Or they mention something specifically that you can help with. Everything up until then is just connecting as a human, you know, not cracking jokes necessarily, unless that's your thing, but finding ways to genuinely connect.
Yeah.
So like if you actually went to the same college as them, then you can talk about the college, or if you went to a rival college. Other than that, don't bring up college. The best outreach I got this year so far is someone who was also in speech and debate in high school. Mm. And we started reminiscing about which events we did and how much fun we had doing it and how it's helped us in our sales career. And at no point did she ask about any problems I had, but she saw me post a rant about something and said, by the way, are you aware that we have a tool that could help with that? And my answer was, yes, I just can't afford you yet. But it was something very simple like that. That's how you can get people. Now, that's a lot harder when you're dealing with buyers that are not on LinkedIn. So for example, at Duckbill Group, our buyers are not on LinkedIn very often at all. We're typically dealing with finance, procurement, and engineers. They're not on LinkedIn a ton. So what we're doing with them is we're taking, basically doing a social nurturing campaign. So we're posting things. April Palmer, who's who's on my sales team, is amazing at this, but she posts probably about a 3-to-1 ratio of content that's valuable to her target audience and one that's valuable for sales. And then sharing things. So every time there's a new podcast that comes out, she has a list of people she's sending it to manually on LinkedIn. Hey, thought this would be interesting to you. Organizing that all in Sales Navigator. And getting that feedback and that, hey, I listened, that was super interesting. Do you have anything else? Yeah, here are three more things. Add value, add value, add value. It's hard when you don't have content. And that's why I say we have to be constantly like, please record things, give us things to starting these conversations with.
Yeah.
But it has to start from an add value place. It will come around. People will get curious. It's one of those weird things about human behavior where if you want to get someone interested in you, ask them about themselves.
Right. Interested is interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. Interested is interesting. The more interested you are in them, they will come around and ask you what you do. They always do. They know you're in sales. They're not stupid. They know. They know what they're getting into. And the fact that you're not pitching them will almost make them more interested. I did some market research last year, actually, that was really interesting. I was deciding whether or not I wanted to do a product, basically. And I did, a couple dozen research calls. And I explained what I was thinking about doing. And the number of people who have followed up with me and said, have you done this? Are you going to do this? I want to buy it. Can we please do this? Is insane. And I'm not doing it. A lot of stuff behind the scenes made it not make sense. But I'm doing these informational calls and I would specifically not pitch. I was just asking questions, explaining, what do you think of this? How would you pay for this? What would you do? And I'd say 90% of those calls resulted in them saying, well, please put me down on the list when this goes live. Or, hey, can you just sign me up? And I'm like, nope, can't do that. This isn't a pitch. I'm not selling you anything. People will sell themselves.
I think that that's a fundamental truism of human nature, and that more prospectors would be wise to pay attention to. Yeah. And that is, you know, when you lead with, you've covered some big themes. You didn't use this word earlier, but I got it in spades with your, you know, Hurricane Sandy stories. When you lead with empathy and you put the other person kind of at the front of the dialogue, and you're genuinely curious and interested in them, what follows is actually a lot of reciprocity, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I kind of avoided using empathy because that was kind of the word of last year. If you listen to anything I did last year, I swear empathy was every fifth word. But no, yeah, it really is. And that's one of the things I look for in hiring sales reps is you have to either be deeply empathetic, I think, or deeply curious. The good news is most people are one or the other. There's very few people in this world that are not one or the other. you just have to have it as a core kind of something you can tap into, because that's a huge key, I think, to motivation in this role when things get crazy.
As an actionable takeaway for the listeners of this podcast, what are some of the ways that you like to screen for that in, say, interview scenarios?
One of my favorite interview questions is, tell me about the last time you really screwed up. And that does a couple different things. One of the primary goal of that question is to, I call it screening for agency. Do they blame everyone else for the problem, or do they own it themselves? And I've heard a lot of, the best answers are ones where it really wasn't their fault, but they took responsibility for it. There have been a few points where, like, yeah, they just got completely screwed by the powers that be, but they're like, you know, I could have planned this and I did this, and here's how I made sure this isn't going to happen again. But part of that is also understanding kind of why and how they got into that situation, and getting introspective about what did I do and what can I do to improve it. That's, if you can't get introspective, you can't really do empathy, because empathy has to start with introspection.
So that's vulnerable for that matter.
Yep. The other thing I look for is, honestly, the biggest way I look for empathy is I actually do mock calls. I love putting people on the spot. I will tell them I'm going to do a mock call in advance. Like, this is a part of the thing. And I always make them do it twice. I do it once and I'm a bit rude.
Okay.
It is not an easy call. It's my goal is to push them to the point where they're making mistakes.
Yeah.
And one of the mistakes I will frequently push people to make is I will force them to make an assumption about my behavior, about who I am, or something like that. And then in the feedback, I correct it.
Mm.
So I'm testing there. One, do they take it on board and apply it on the next call? And two, do they then kind of apply that empathy and start thinking about things a little bit differently?
So what would be a good example of, like, how you could force someone to make an assumption?
One of my favorite ways is just to talk about budget.
Okay.
Or so whether that's, oh, my boss is never going to approve this. I can't, you know, so usually something about approvals.
Yeah.
Mostly because if you haven't done this before, you don't understand how approvals work, and that sounds like a really firm no. It's like, no, that's a push off. Anyone can get budget. It's just a matter of how easy it is, and more specifically, how big the pain is.
Yeah.
So a lot of times I'll do something like that and I'll challenge them afterwards. I'll be like, okay, so you were talking to a head of sales and they said they didn't have budget. If your car gets a flat tire, do you have budget to fix it?
Yes.
If the VP of sales has a problem, do you think the head of finance is going to give him budget?
Yep.
So you assumed that this person genuinely didn't have any money.
Right.
So that's one thing. Two, it's not your job to screen for budget most times. So it's fine. Just educate about the problem, offer to add some value, make his time a little bit easier, because you know he has these really hard things he has to deal with every day. Use it to flip it into a place of empathy. I can understand, you know, things are tight. We're working on, everyone's focusing more on retention rather than hiring, which can be expensive. We've got some ways that we might be able to help with that. You know, show some empathy there. And that's usually the way you counter it is, I understand. A lot of the people I talk with in your role are dealing with X.
Yeah.
So, and that's a matter of doing your homework as much as anything else. But that's what good managers will do, is they'll help them do your homework. You'll help your team do their homework, so they're prepared for stuff like that.
Yeah, that's always the most underused technique in prospecting and sales development. And I always fail to understand why.
I know for a lot of people that I've trained over the years, one of their biggest blockers mentally is, why should they listen to me?
Right.
There's a real inferiority complex, and we drill it into the sales. We drill it into SDRs. It drives me nuts. The SDRs do not have to understand everything about the product. They do not need to know everything about the industry to add value.
They may be better off not knowing.
In many cases, there are. I've got a whole other speech on that. But that doesn't mean that you can't understand and empathize with the person on the other side of the phone.
Right.
That connection is where the meeting comes from, not your knowledge of the product.
Yeah.
So start with, I understand that most people in your role have these problems. That sounds really annoying. I have never been there. I don't know. Don't pretend you understand. You don't. But you can empathize. I can empathize. That sounds That's something I don't want to deal with. Holy cow. But that's one of the reasons that makes our product great is we can help take this off your hands. So you can focus on the other things that you really care about. That's a human connection. That's what drives meaningful meetings. You want your show rate to be good, have a person-to-person connection, not a feature connection.
Right.
Feature connections, problems can wax and wane in terms of severity, but, oh, I have to show up to this meeting because Ashley and I had this great conversation. I told her I'd show up.
Yeah.
There's a personal responsibility. There's a guilt that comes. I mean, just think about it. You know, show a friend for coffee or something like that. You feel bad. You're texting saying, I'm so sorry. I have to cancel. Stuff happens. It's okay. Versus no showing a banker or something like that. Is it rude? Yes. But do we feel nearly as guilty? No, because we're thinking about the feature that we're going to get out of it.
Yep. Yeah. So. I think that that's exactly right. And I always am fond of saying the SDR role is impossible because you've, by definition, never done the job of the people you're calling into.
Yeah.
But that's actually what makes it empathy such a really important piece of the puzzle going forward. The other thing that I think is probably, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts on this. Oftentimes, I think a lot of junior employees, and by definition, that's most SDRs, love to overtalk their way into or out of anything.
Oh, God.
And one of the things that they fail to realize is questions that I can't answer are actually a great reason to start a sales cycle or to set a meeting.
Oh, God. Yeah. I tell my SDRs, the moment they ask a question that's not who are you, the moment they ask a question about anything to do with the product, that's the moment you start closing.
Yeah.
Hey, great question. Let's grab some time in the books. We can dive into that and everything else. Because now they've got a reason to show up because they want to hear the answer to that question. It doesn't always work because a lot of times there are what I call table stakes.
Sure.
I need to know baseline pricing before I'm going to commit to a meeting. Totally fair. I need to know whether or not you can sync with Salesforce or you can integrate with this system or that. Those are baseline questions. You have to answer those. You can't do that. But the moment's like, yeah, we integrate with Salesforce. No problem. We can do X, Y, and Z. You know, okay, great. Well, hey, tell me more about how this feature works. You know, I'm actually probably not the best person to even explain it that well. What I think would be the best use of your time would be for me to get a product expert on the line. They'll walk you through it. I promise I won't just be us talking at you for 30 minutes straight. No lectures. We'll make it highly interactive and actionable so you walk away with some good information. If it's a fit, great. If it's not, no big deal. 15, 30 minutes max, we figure out if this is something we want to continue exploring or not. You know, and then go to a presumptive. I'm a huge fan there. Go to a presumptive close. What does next Thursday look like?
Yep.
Pick a day of the week. What does this look like? Get them to give you a time. Go from there.
By the way, the last 45 seconds of your talk track, so many healthy habits in there. It's not even funny, right? Like the ability
to
give
people. I'm good at this.
Well, you're really good at it. But seriously, the ability to give people outs, the ability to go for the assumptive close, the ability to be humble and, you know, have that humility to let the prospect, you know that this isn't your area of expertise. Psst, we're not going to get married on the first date. This would be a relationship that actually goes through, you know, phases and cycles, should there be a fit.
I use dating as an analogy all the time. And I talk to, like I explained the sales cycle, the SDR is speed dating.
Right.
They're just trying to figure out if it's worth having a drink with this person. The AE is the one that's trying to actually figure out, is this a relationship? Are we compatible? Do we want the same things from this? Okay, we're aligned and all that. All right, let's move in together. All right, let's get a dog. All right, let's get married. All right, let's start a family or not. Let's move to the other side of the world during the middle of a pandemic because we're crazy. You know, you take these steps along the way and it's a continual commitment process. The sale does not end when they sign the contract. You still have to be continually reselling, constantly checking in. Is this still worth it to you? Are our goals still aligned? Are you still seeing value in this? That's how you prevent churn. And I really think that one of the most underfunded, under-talked about areas in sales is customer success and post-sales support.
Yeah.
We're going to see, I feel like sales development, the growth of sales development was 2000 through 2020. I feel like 2020 through 2040 is going to be all post-sale support and customer success.
Interesting.
So SDRs, if you're listening to this and you don't want to be an AE, holy cow, look into customer success.
That's a very fair point. You know, the other thing that I would attach to that idea, the part of it that really resonates with me, is I actually think some of the best prospecting messaging that you can develop is truly understanding customer success scenarios of the personas of the people that some people would call an ICP, that are, why'd they buy from you? What were the problems that they were looking to solve in their words?
I worked for a company. I've seen two companies do this really well. One company, as a part of the monthly all hands, would bring in a customer and do a fireside chat with them every month in front of the whole company. And this was a 1,000-person company. Every month they brought in a customer who was doing something cool with our product. Those were gold for prospecting.
Yeah.
And also it also meant that I, as a manager, never had to bug my team to go to the company all hands. They all showed up. They also would all put their laptops away when those fireside chats started, which meant you knew they were really paying attention. They weren't, you know, subtly using outreach in the background. But another thing I've seen do really well is another company I worked with, and we even do a version of this at Duckbill Group. We send basically post-sale surveys. And one of the questions on there is around what made you say yes.
Yeah.
And sharing that and making that public, not just with the AEs, but with the prospecting team, so that you can start seeing things. And it's so powerful when you're on a call and you can say, huh, it's really interesting you mentioned this is happening. We just had a customer last week who onboarded with us 3 months ago say this. They said yes for the same reason, and these are their current results. It sounds like it's BS to the other person as well, but you're like, and you can even say, I love doing this because I love calling it out. Be like, I know this sounds crazy, but this really did just happen. And I'd be happy to put you know, obviously, if it makes sense down the line, I'm happy to give you proof I'm not lying about this. And go from there. Just being able to give those stories, even if you can't name drop, even if you can't attribute it to anything, you can say, oh, you know, I just heard from another customer in the same industry as you, or this, or similar spend level as you, or similar this to you, or just another company who had the same problem. And this is what they got out of it. So powerful.
Or another big one that I've never seen anyone be uncomfortable with, the NDA, if you will, same title. Yeah. Right. So the title is little, or it's underappreciated in the sense that if you are a VP of marketing, you will have similar struggles. Again, it might be completely different if your business is $10 billion a year ARR versus, you know, $1 million a year ARR. But the title itself is worried about the same general things.
Yeah.
There's the same sorts of like types of challenges and problems that are associated with a given title, a given role.
Yep. And that's really true. I do always caution on those, is you do always have to take into account a bit size of company. I cannot tell you how many times people prospect me, for example, and be like, oh, we work with coaches like, you know, million plus follower people. I'm like, ha, 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 useless. I'm not there. I don't care. The best examples I love slash hate. When I go into a company and I see they're talking about, oh, we currently work with companies like Google and Microsoft, and they list a bunch of the FANG companies or other really big ticket companies. I'm like, tell me about your ICP. Yeah, we're targeting SaaS companies between you know 150 and 2,000 employees. And I'm like, so why are you mentioning Google? Oh, because it's good name recognition. Great, pick one of those. Pick one for name recognition. Ooh, they're working with Google. Google does some cool stuff. Oh, they're working with two other companies that are similar to me. Maybe they're a couple steps ahead. I think a couple steps ahead is great. So if you're in that 100 to 2,000 employee range, you can list people the 2,000 employee range at the top end. That's fine because everyone thinks they're going to get there eventually. That's good. But it's like looking at the largest house on your street. Oh yeah, I'm totally going to be there someday. No worries. But you drive to the nicest part of town and see the crazy mansions, that feels a step too far for most people. Like you tell them, you could live there one day. Everyone's going to be like, okay, not everyone. 90% of people are going to be like, yeah, okay, sure. That'd be nice. You're not ruling it out, but you're raising an eyebrow.
Well, and it gets you to the wrong side of social proof as opposed to the right side of social proof.
Yeah. And again, it comes back to empathy. What are they going to empathize with? You don't empathize with Google. You empathize with your competitor. You empathize with a company that you're at least loosely familiar with, that you know their story, you know, or something like that. Or, oh, I'm vaguely familiar with what they do. Oh, they've got a good reputation. Oh, they're, you know, oh, they just raised a new round of funding. I want to raise a round of funding in a year or two. That'd be great. You know, it can be stuff as simple as that. Also, please stop sending prospecting emails off of fundraising rounds. Everyone does it. All the founders are sick of it. They ignore all of it. And just because they have money does not mean they want to give it to you. If you want to trigger off funding rounds, trigger off people who have gone 18 months since a funding round and start prospecting them then. If you haven't gotten to them by the time they've closed the round, you're not getting that money, at least for another 4 or 5 months.
I really like prospecting into fundraising rounds, but not the day of announcement. I think that the time block in my career, having worked for quite a lot of venture-backed startups, you're usually looking at least a 90-day window before deployment of funds, which is usually when nobody's around, nobody's prospect, no one's referencing last quarter's funding, but this quarter's deliverables or KPIs or now the expectations that funding brings, which is...
I gave 4 months.
Yeah. I think that that's probably the right gestation period, if you will. And you're going to get less saturation for the prospect set in general.
Now, that said, what I have done, Mattermark was great for this back in the day when I worked there. What we would do is we would actually add companies that raised a funding round to specific marketing campaigns. And they start getting drips from marketing stuff for 3 to 4 months. So then by the time sales is reaching out, they've seen our name 8 to 10 times.
Love that.
Then it feels like a much warmer conversation. So that's a great conversation as an SDR manager, as an AE, go to marketing. Hey, I'd love to see a nurture campaign where I can just add people when they do a funding round. And then when they exit it 4 months later, then it triggers my team. You know, they can MQL, they interact with it a ton, but we're really not going to touch them for 3 to 4 months unless they're actively like, hey, tell me more about your stuff, because they're just going to be overrun.
Yeah, or hanging like ad air cover is another great way of doing this.
Yep.
So when you target
people... I know far less about that. Do not ask me about anything to do with that.
Well, listeners can come to Science when they want to do things like that. I'd actually love to head back to something that you were talking about earlier, because you mentioned, especially with the companies that you consult into, you know, you're going to walk in and you're going to recommend 10 things to do. So a lot of the times it's stuff that the SDR manager already recommended. But I'm curious what a lot of those scenarios represent as, or what are some of the common, like you said, hey, stuff was working, then it stopped working. Give me a flavor for some of those talk tracks that you look to get into to really drive value as a consultant around, you know, kind of those 10 things you're recommending.
They can go a lot of different ways, but I'd say two of the most common things I end up jumping into and are, again, super nuanced and very wildly, are messaging and metrics. So just straight up, everyone knows things change quickly. And there's this weird sweet spot we have to hit in sales between being responsive, but still being data-driven. And that's a hard balance to find. So a lot of times they're skewing one way or the other with their messaging. They're either being so responsive, they're not getting any good data. I worked with a company last year. They had me come in to clean up their outreach instance. They had over 900 sequences spread across, I think, 50 SDRs worldwide.
Wow.
Yeah. I think there were 5 sequences that had more than 100 people in them. Like that data was useless. Like they came in like, tell us what's working. I'm like, I can't, because none of this has any, not even statistical significance, because that's a high bar. None of these even have enough to really have trends yet. So that was one side. Or it's the opposite. It's they're still using the same messaging they were using 6, 8, 9 months ago. People tend to be smarter than using messaging for a year. But so it's getting people at that point on a 3-month cadence review cycle. That's a pretty easy one to do. On the other side, it's getting everyone standardized onto, okay, what are the 30 sequences that will cover 80% of what your SDRs are doing? Let's get those built and get those deployed. Go from there. That's the messaging side. The metric side is the other side of it. And more often than not, that's just a case of misalignment. And this is where it gets really tricky, because I'm aware of my position as an influencer, as it were. But there are a lot of influencers who are sharing metrics. And a lot of leaders see those metrics and then go, well, why can't we do that?
Yeah.
Without interrogating where did those metrics come from?
No context whatsoever.
Yeah. The number of times, it's now, honestly, it's become a little bit, I love this book. It's great. But like the number of times I see like someone talking about, God, now I'm forgetting the name of the book. There's a huge book that came out 4 or 5 years ago and every VP of sales was running it forever. And then they're like, well, why doesn't it work?
Sales acceleration formula.
Thank you. Yeah. It's now become a thing where like, if someone's like, hey, we want to think about bringing you on. I just read the sales acceleration formula. Like internally, I die a little. Because one, that book's over 10 years old now. There's a ton of great stuff in it. If you haven't read it, I actually do recommend you read it. But a lot of people take that as a Bible.
Yeah.
And just like with any text, in my opinion, not to get political or religious, every piece of text has to be considered in the context with which it was written. Okay. So yeah, no, I'm not going to bring up the Bible or the Constitution, but there are a lot of things in there that don't make sense in the modern world. And there are originalists who believe that we should go by it. I tend to disagree with them. No, I flat out do disagree with them. I absolutely disagree with them. I actively fight against them. And then there are people who are trying to take the core important things from that text and apply it to the modern world. Sales acceleration formula and pretty much anything you see from an influencer has to have that same process applied on it. And a lot of people, especially if they come from an engineering background, can't do that because their world is see problem, see solution, implement solution, it works. And you just troubleshoot code, not to minimize what that is in any way. I can't do it. Sales is different because we're throwing three levels of humanity into it. So you have to take it, you have to throw in your product, you have to throw in your process, you have to throw in your people and your prospects. That will change it every single time. So a lot of times those conversations, when I'm talking to them about, generally even before I start, I'm talking to them about that process. And if they're just like, nope, we need to hit this, we've committed to our VCs, I'm like, you know what, then this is not a good fit. Maybe not that directly. But I would say at least a third of the conversations I have, I bow out because I'm seeing signs of stuff like that. I can't take your money when I know you're not going to listen to me at least a little bit, but also just that's no fun for me. I do enjoy the mental side of stepping back and going, you know, kind of being disconnected from having to do a lot of the things. That's nice for a change, but I can't get into it and believe in what I'm doing and the time that we're taking away from my husband and my life that I want to live. I don't care how good the money is if there's not a chance of it actually making something better. So there are certain things I'm screening for. And the same thing that I'm screening for in clients, SDR should know what those red flags are to screen for in prospects. What are the technical minimums that they need? What are the, you know, kind of, what are the things that are involved in the ICP beyond company size and title? You have to know more than that. It has to come down to what technology do they need to have? What organizational needs do they need to have? And if these things aren't present, it can't be qualified. A lot of, I think, young companies especially go way too broad. They think, oh, this could be used by every vertical. Yeah, and it's like, yes, it could. What are the easiest three? Let's start there. And then we'll keep expanding. But that's a huge, huge, huge issue a lot of companies deal with. And that's another thing I kind of watch for. I'm like, you don't want to hire me until you've got at least those first three starting to get tested.
It's so funny. You reference the sales acceleration formula. Great book. I agree with you 100%. But one of the biggest lessons that I've always took from it is the one I see implemented the least, which is when Marc Roberge, who I know and great, great guy too, as well as being a great author. One of the things that I think he stumbled upon that was so valuable that he captured in that book was the way in which HubSpot would actually train their SDRs to be successful by making them walk a mile in a marketer's shoes, making them, hey, you got to set up your own blog. Hey, you got to do all these marketing activities. You can't sell to marketers until you understand marketers or develop empathy around their role. And so to me, that was like, I still have yet to see any SDR teams doing likewise, like what HubSpot used to do. And I believe they still do to a certain extent. But that seems to be missing in action.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It is missing in action from a lot. It's hard because for, I'd say about 80 to 90% of products, you can't you can't do a security admin's job. You can't do an engineer's job. You can't do these things. But one of the things I will do with my teams when you can't do the job is, okay, you have to like write a book report. I'm never going to forget my first day in sales. I was working for Arista Networks, which was selling 10 gigabit Ethernet switches. I have a degree in music and political science. I know nothing about any of this stuff. They literally put a copy of Networking for Dummies on my desk. No, they didn't even put a copy of it. They gave me time off to go find a Barnes & Noble that had it in stock. And I went and drove and bought it. And in hindsight, they didn't reimburse my mileage, which was not good. But thinking through these things, that book was essential. That was huge. Just giving me that base knowledge to understand enough about it. And then what they did was I sat in on a ton of sales calls. So I was sitting in on 2 to 3 hours of sales calls a day and calls that I was never going to run just so that I could hear how they spoke and the terms they were using. Now, a better version of that that I implement with a lot of my clients is I suggest that the SDR managers or the AEs record client interviews. Tell me about your day job. You know, what's a day in the life like? How'd you get to your job? What credentials did you need? What education did you need? What were some of the more formative experiences that got you to your job? And the way I typically recommend they organize it is 30 minutes to 45 minutes, depending on how much time they'll give you. Half that time should not be spent on your product. It should be spent on how they got to where they are in their career. Then the last half is about what made you, how'd you find us? What's useful about our product? What do you like about our product? What do you hate about our product? Kind of stuff like that. And I've gotten a couple sales teams to get to the point where they commit to giving us, you know, 2 to 5 of those a quarter. And then we just have a bank of them. And anything that's more than a year old, you drop off. You got new ones coming in. And part of your onboarding is you have to go listen to all of those and pick your 3 favorites.
I love that. Is a keeper of a suggestion going forward, especially with the prevalence of Gong or Chorus or everything else. Yeah. Ashley, this conversation has been absolutely wonderful and you've dropped a ton of insights. Tell us, where can people connect with you or find out more about what you're up to?
Yeah, easiest place, find me on LinkedIn. So linkedin.com/in/AshleyEarly, spell it like the crazy person I am. So A-S-H-L-E-I-G-H, early, like early in the morning. You can also find me on Twitter at Ashley at Work. That's name A-T, Work. It's a really deep cut Star Trek reference. And then but the biggest thing is honestly, make sure, please, please, please go check out othersideofsales.com. That is the podcast that I run with several of my partners, devoted to making B2B sales truly inclusive so everyone can thrive. We feature interviews with sales pros. We talk about how they got to where they got to in their career, what their experience is like, all those things that can help build empathy so we can get more inclusive and keep more people in sales. That's really kind of the big problem I'm trying to solve as kind of a passion project. We're doing a better job getting people of diverse backgrounds into sales. We're doing a terrible job of keeping them. And one of the biggest reasons I think is we're not having tough conversations and we're not doing a good enough job promoting and showing that you can do this and be successful. Someone who looks like you, who thinks like you, who has the same background as you is killing it. And so can you. So check out othersideofsales.com. We've got the blog, the podcast, and a lot more coming in the next few months. So make sure to go there and sign up for the email list.
I love that. Wonderful, noble work. Thank you for your time today. Great conversation.
This has been fun. Thank you so much.